2. The War Hawk. Sam is gone when she wakes up at 5:30 the next morning. He told her he had to meet a guy about something. She understands what meeting a guy about something means and didn't press him on it. Haley can't say she was especially eager for an awkward goodbye either. With much to be done today, Haley needs her focus uncluttered. As always, she needs her space. Ending her training with Frederik Kozlov doesn't mean stopping her workout routine. Since her army days, Haley has remained ferociously devoted to physical exercise. Her mental fitness depends on that relentless discipline. Chaotic events in the last months of her tenure in the West Wing interrupted those routine efforts. Despite placing herself under the Russians' tutelage, Haley has yet to regain her previous levels of fitness. Her levels of strength and stamina remain frustratingly subpar. The bedrock of her exercise regimen is running. When she was young, not yet a teenager, running was how she got around. To friends' houses, to school, on errands to the store for her mother. No one in her class, male or female, could run faster. As she grew older and competed in school track team events, her discipline sharpened. With coaching, technique augmented her natural talent for the sport. Other passions eventually displaced Haley's devotion to running. Extracurricular activities that were not strictly legal. But she never wholly stopped indulging in a long, solitary slog. Running was freedom. Running was sanity. Even in the worst days of her work in the Monroe White House, Haley found fleeting respite in intermittent early morning runs through the deserted streets of Washington. She dresses quickly in her usual workout clothes. A cherished PT uniform from her time in the military long since become threadbare. Haley was forced to look for an alternative. High-performance, quick-drying fabrics, stretchy lining, and pockets for keys and IDs are all improvements she accepts as a worthwhile trade-off. Dressed and out the door less than 7 minutes after waking up, Haley takes the stairs down to the first floor and bangs out the apartment building's entry door. Free again. In the pre-dawn silence, the rhythmic thud of her shoes hitting the pavement keeps time to her light exertion. Warm up first. Loosen joints and muscles. Despite the early hour, the air is already thick and muggy. A good sweat is trivial work in a Washington summer. Wait for it, Haley reminds herself. She heads east on P Street, cutting through a deserted Logan Circle, to 12th, where she turns right and south. With 2 more hours before the morning rush, she can run down the middle of the street unencumbered. The domed rotunda that defines the National Museum of Natural History comes into view, thrusting above the modern architectural mess surrounding it. Her destination is the car-free, uninterrupted paths of the National Mall. Here she can begin to push it, elevating her pace and heart rate. A full loop is 4.3 miles. Haley plans to run it twice, her usual output. One loop is completed in about 35 minutes. Maintaining a strong pace, just under 8 minutes per mile, and takes her past all of the iconic sights, silent and shrouded in the dawn's half-light. World War II Memorial, Reflecting Pool, Washington Monument, Lincoln Memorial, Tidal Basin, White House. Empty of tourists, the scene is apocalyptic. Only a passing Metropolitan Police Department patrol car disrupts an otherwise fixed tableau. She increases her pace for the second loop. Sweat flowing. Consciousness loosens its moorings. Thoughts swirl. Haley makes no effort to corral her deliberations. She thinks of her father. His ugly suicide. Sam in her arms the night before. El Paso, and the near certain pathos that await her there. Haley imagines a storm forming on the horizon. In that vision, she sees herself running directly at the tempest. What is this compulsion? Returning to Princeton, West Virginia, and her training with Kozlov would be so much easier. Finishing the second loop in front of the Natural History Museum, Haley pauses, bent over with a hand on each knee. Her pulse seems high, far more so than usual. She's hyperventilating again, too. What is wrong with me? Am I sick? Haley straightens again and resumes at a gentler tempo, heading north up 12th Street. The easy jog to Logan Circle takes less than 10 minutes. Haley feels no satisfying sense of resolution, no closer to a decision than when she had set out 90 minutes earlier. Should she go to West Texas or not? Cutting across the park, Haley sees April Wu sitting on one of the benches. She slows to a stop. You again? April looks no healthier than she did 2 days ago and wears the same black hoodie and cargo pants. If anything, the morning sunlight makes her complexion seem even more pallid. She manages an impish grin anyway. I can't quit you, Haley Chill. Very funny. That's a movie reference, right? Are you okay? Asks April. Haley was unaware she is grimacing. I'm fine. Calf muscles a little sore. She sits down on the bench and massages her leg. Come on, Chill, you can do better than that. Which calf muscles? Peroneus longus, tibialis anterior maybe a little. Haley traces her finger lower down the back of her leg to the heel. Not this one. Extensor digitorum longus, asshole. Haley asks, why does everything have to be a competition between us? Because it's fun as fuck. There's that. Pretty dope guillotine choke the other night. Too bad you were the one wearing it. Some friend you are. We're friends? Asks April. Haley has worked out the tightness in her calf, sits up straight. A wise man once said, trust no one. He's dead. Somebody killed him. Then, without missing a beat, seen Sam? Yes. The silence elongates. It's up to Haley to fill the void. A relationship is not something I'm particularly well-equipped to pull off. I know the feeling. Look, April. Haley is distracted, wants out of there, but her sickly friend seems in no rush to leave. What did you find dumpster diving at your dad's place? Are you following me? Asks Haley, irritated. I don't need to follow you to know what you're going to do. That's how it works, huh? That's how it works. Haley feels the sweat drying from her forearms. The oaks of Logan Circle sway in a morning breeze. She takes a deep inhale, wishing she knew what to do without talking to April Wu about it. My dad made multiple trips down to El Paso, Texas. Contacts I haven't been able to run down yet. Andrew Wilde? Asks April. Not yet. Don't go rogue on us, slugger. Rogue, give me a break. Go, but don't go it alone. Get Publius behind you. Have their blessing in your hip pocket. Who knows what you're going to find down there? Haley says nothing, watching the worker bees of Washington, D.C. hurry past in all directions. Again, she envies them for their ordinary jobs, their ordinary lives. What? Where is the problem here? Asks April. This is about me. What happened to my father? Someone else can save the country. Don't be whack. I'm serious. I know. And you're also whack. It's a 1 hour drive from Washington, west on the interstate, and then south after passing the battlefield at Manassas. Haley keeps the radio off and windows down, filling the car with the smells of late summer in rural Virginia. Andrew Wilde provided her with detailed directions to the location. Nothing new in that. Missing the turnoff for the farm would have been a near certainty without those careful, Wilde-esque instructions. Her destination discourages visitors, accidental or intended. Haley wonders if she has gone off track somewhere along the line. The rutted gravel road seemingly unused in recent times, when she clocks 3 big black SUVs parked on a grass-covered ridge. Hearing the fusillade of gunshots confirms that she has arrived. Haley parks, her Volkswagen Golf dwarfed by the hulking SUVs. The range shack is on the other side of the hill, accessed by a dirt path. The facility, bare bones in the extreme, is divided between a range for long guns on the right and an urban gallery to the left. As she descends the path, Haley observes 5 shooters, male and female, practicing drills at the urban range's firing line. After retrieving eye and ear protection from a cardboard box on the porch of the rain shack, she takes a rock stairway down and pauses at the bottom step. The Urban Shooting Gallery offers several different types of steel targets, silhouettes, and discs, some of which are placed behind old automobiles or partially obscured by plywood walls at distances varying between 20 and 50 feet. Working through a drill, a shooter changes positions behind several barricades that force an alteration of firing stances. The idea is the creation of a more accurate simulation of real-world combat conditions. Drawing the weapon and reloading increases the challenge of maintaining speed and accuracy. Haley watches shooters take turns on the firing line. Tactical holsters and magazine pouches adorn their duty belts. Pressing a button on a wrist-mounted shot timer activates a 3-second delayed buzzer that signals the drill's start. The shooter fires on predetermined targets in sequence, hitting as many as possible before the end of par time, which is signaled by a second buzzer. In their current drill, the shooters, all middle-aged or older, are limited to a 10-second par time. None of them appear to work their way through the entire course of targets, barely expending an 8-round magazine and reloading before the second buzzer goes off. One of the shooters is Andrew Wilde, wearing pressed jeans, Timberlands, and a polo shirt rather than his customary blue suit. Haley nearly didn't recognize her superior. Having just completed his turn at the firing line, shooting a Glock 17 and hitting 11 targets in par time, he glances over his shoulder at her. Haley offers him a polite golf clap. His expression isn't warm, but she wouldn't expect it to be. Possessing a brusque managerial style, Wilde has never been anything but businesslike with the deeper state operative. Haley is confident that he respects her skills. She simply isn't certain that he likes her. The last shooter has a turn on the firing line. An elderly gentleman who appears quite spry despite his 77 years. Armed with a Colt 1911-style pistol, he activates the shot timer strapped to his wrist and, with the first buzzer, draws cleanly and starts firing, hitting 3 targets in sequence, shifting to the other side of an obstacle and firing 3 more times, all direct hits. He shifts again, hits 2 more targets farther downrange, releases the mag and reloads. The second buzzer goes off before he can get off any more shots, ending with 8 targets hit in par time. Some pretty good shooting. The other shooters respectfully applaud. With a friendly grin, the white-haired geezer holsters his weapon. As a former U.S. president, his name is on a major airport in his home state and almost entirely out of the current news. He takes note of their newly arrived spectator and gives her a wink. Haley nods deferentially and remains at the bottom of the overlapping stone stairway, giving distance to the shooters and excited chatter that follows their shooting drills. A bearded ball-capped instructor in his mid-30s provides tips to his elderly clients. Wilder gestures to Haley. She joins him as they stroll the short distance to the long gun shooting range for some privacy.
"We were just talking about you."
Haley glances behind her, back toward the pistol range. The former president has interrupted the range instructor and regales his captive audience with a story they have no choice but to appreciate. "All with Publius, sir?"
Wilder nods. "You recognize?"
"The president, of course. And Stanley Teller, former vice chairman of the Board of Governors, Federal Reserve. Major General Lawrence Chambers recently stepped down from command of Army Intelligence and Security. I'm surprised to see Senator Conkle on the range. Didn't she get a grade of F from the NRA?
There's the public persona, and then there's the person.
Meredith has opted to let her hair down a little in her retirement. He looks Haley up and down, his eyes hidden by dark aviator sunglasses.
You look fit.
MMA training, sir, in West Virginia. He waves his hand as if swatting away a persistent mosquito.
Christ, I know all of that.
Of course, sir.
Get enough time away, chill. Cooking up a new project for you.
Project, sir?
Overseas, our embassy in London. Your passport is in order?
Yes, sir. Her voice is a bit vacant. Wilde doesn't fail to detect her subdued reaction to news of her next assignment.
What's wrong? You have something against bangers and mash?
I've been working on something here, sir. On my own. A hearty round of laughter from the adjacent range distracts a visibly impatient Andrew Wilde for a brief moment. True to form, he fails to appreciate Haley's mild pushback.
What sort of something?
I'm not entirely sure. Haley is aware of how evasive she sounds. I've barely scratched the surface.
Sounds definitive, Wilde says with acid.
Haley finds it difficult to meet her superior's gaze and decides silence is the best option here. Her boss digs in.
You're on the prowl, Ms. Chill.
Of what? She hesitates, because she is in the possession of so few hard facts. The truth. Wilde's brow couldn't furrow more than it does.
What the hell is this all about?
Choosing her words carefully, Haley says, Rafit Zamani, sir. The NSA contractor behind this year's cyber attacks.
I'm not senile, I remember Zamani.
When he infiltrated Pentagon servers, sir, he weaponized the data and targeted me, to impede my pursuit of him. Rafit Zamani. Speaking the name again brings a rush of memories. Those dark days of last spring feel as if another lifetime. But only 3 months have passed since the computer hacker brought Washington, D.C., and much of the eastern United States to its knees with a series of escalating cyber attacks. Haley and April Wu, as operatives of the deeper state, identified and stopped the mentally unbalanced young man. Their efforts saved hundreds of lives, and kinetic war with Russia was averted. But the costs of their success were high. A car would not have crashed and run over April Wu were it not for Zamani's takedown of the East Coast's electrical grid, and Haley would have remained blissfully unaware of the truth regarding her father. She could have sailed through her entire life with the belief that Tommy Chill died in Iraq, instead of discovering his body hanging from a bedroom door in Arlington, Virginia.
You know, we got a look at the contents of Zamani's computer, Wilde says cryptically.
Haley hadn't considered the possibility. Then you know that Charlie Hicks was responsible for my father's death in Iraq. Testing him. Seeing how much her superior really knows.
Andrew Wilde couldn't care less about Haley's shattered family history. He has a job to do. So, it's Hicks you're looking into. Weeks dead, by his own hand.
Haley is oddly relieved. He doesn't have even half of the story. She says,
You can hardly blame me, sir, wanting to know the truth.
Wilde is unmoved.
We need you on a London-bound plane tonight, Chill.
Without waiting for her response, he starts back toward the other range. Haley is a soldier, first and foremost. She took an oath, administered to her by a former Supreme Court justice in a helicopter's jump seat after her last day at the Deeper States training camp in Oregon. If Publius orders her to go to London, Haley will go.
Yes, sir.
Wilde nods as she falls in behind him, satisfied with her response. He didn't expect anything less than her total dedication and obedience. Haley turns to climb the steps back up to the range shack. The former president gestures toward Haley.
This her, Andy? Is this our intrepid Haley Chill?
She turns and faces the great man. Arms straight at her side, she offers an almost imperceptible nod. Mr. President.
For gosh sake, shake an old man's hand.
The president thrusts his hand toward Haley, who obliges him. Andrew Wilde watches like the corner grocer over his wares.
Did Andy fill you in? What do you think about this business in London?
Wilde answers for her.
I'd just mentioned it, Mr. President. I have a full briefing packet for her in the car. Excellent.
The former president fixes his gaze on Haley, but with his trademark grin, folksy and mostly genuine.
The work you're doing, young lady, keeping in the shadows, taking no credit when credit is most certainly due, well, see, that's just part of the job. You and I were lifelong public servants, get me?
Yes, sir.
Gesturing with both hands, the former president continues.
You more than most, Haley. Andy filled me in, gave me the whole lowdown. What you've done for your country, young lady, that personal sacrifice cannot be misoverestimated.
Haley maintains a placid expression and says nothing in response.
Shall we have another go at it, sir?
Asks Wilde, tilting his thumb toward the range.
Sure, sure. Let's make some noise.
He looks at Haley again.
You do some good over there in London, okay, Haley? Keep us posted.
The former president turns away, heading back toward the firing line, but then stops. That down-home grin again. Got him reelected despite a war and a bad economy.
Say, didn't I hear you know your way around a gun? He asks.
Andrew Wilde steps between Haley and the former president.
That's enough. Let's not keep the president from his shooting.
But the older man with a glint in his eye shoos away Wilde with a wave of his hand. Haley says, expert badge in the army, Mr. President, and some further tactical training at the camp in Oregon. He grins devilishly, sensing the opportunity for a bit of fun.
Want to have a go, pretty lady? Show us what you got.
The former senator seems perturbed by the old man's choice of words and makes a disgruntled sound that only encourages her antagonist.
Oh, come on, Mayor. I can't keep up with what's allowed and what's not. See, my plan is staying with what I'm used to. They can't exactly vote me out of office now, can they?
He turns back to the deeper state operative.
That okay with you, Haley?
Yes, sir. Of course. His grin grows even toothier.
Then why not give the old warhawk a try?
The former president draws his handgun, checks to see the chamber is clear and safety is on, then offers the pistol to Haley Chill. She accepts the weapon and holds it admiringly in her hand. That is one beautiful gun, sir.
Damn straight it is. The manufacturer, Nighthawk Custom, was kind enough to send it over on my 75th birthday. Entirely handmade by a single gunsmith. 45 caliber, light rail as you can see.
Haley completes the inventory. DLC finish, rail scales, carbon fiber grips, GI style thumb safety, gold bead front sight, Black Legend back. She rechecks the chamber, racks the slide, testing the fit of slide to frame, and then holds the gun out at arm's length. Nice. Based on the Colt government designed by John Browning in 1911, hence the original model name, the handcrafted pistol is both a work of art and a fearsome weapon. The former president is a delighted owner, gazing on the gun as if it were his firstborn.
Go on, take her for a spin. Let's see what a real shooter can do with her.
Thank you, sir. I'd like that very much. Andrew Wilde frowns but says nothing. The former president unbuckles his duty belt.
Here you go. Cinch that up a notch or two.
Haley holsters the gun and straps on the belt, checking the location of gun and mags without looking.
What do you think? Gonna work for you, Haley? Asks the old man.
Yes, sir. I think I'm all set. The former president has the shot timer on his wrist ready. He stays close behind Haley as she approaches the firing line.
10-second par time. Shooter ready? He asks.
The other shooters and their instructor watch with keen interest. Haley's arms hang easily at her side. She is composed, breathing steadily. She is still. The words of her trainer at the camp in Oregon come back to her. A mental checklist that is more about focusing her attentions than anything else. About freeing herself from the clutter in her mind and doing only this one thing. Sights, slack out, pressure wall, press, reset. I'm ready.
Go!
The old man activates the shot timer. In 3 seconds, the first buzzer sounds. Haley draws the warhawk cleanly and brings the pistol up, favoring her dominant eye. She fires 3 times in quick succession, shifts, fires 3 more times, shifts, and fires 2 more times, releases the mag and reloads, bringing the warhawk up and firing 3 more times, shifting, 3 more shots, moving, and a final 2 shots as the second buzzer sounds. Par time. All target assignments hit.
Ha! Damn! The old man slaps his thigh.
He turns to the others, grinning like a school kid.
You see that? 16 dingers in under 10 seconds.
Humble to a fault, Haley says nothing, exchanging the empty mag for a full one. Major General Chambers, previously with Army Intelligence and Security, isn't impressed.
Course record for that target sequence is 9 seconds, sir.
Oh, yeah? 100 says she can do it, Larry.
You got yourself a bet, Mr. President.
The old man turns to Haley.
Ready when you are, young lady.
9 seconds part-time. Haley is at the line. Shooter ready.
Go!
Haley draws. With additional familiarity of her equipment and the target sequence, her movements are even quicker, more efficient. Moving through the series of targets, not a single moment goes to waste. She finishes just as the second buzzer sounds.
Yes, ma'am! 16 dingers, all of them centerline!
He turns around, crouching a bit, and then jetting upright, his right fist thrust into the air.
That's $100, Larry.
The Army General is unwilling to concede defeat.
Double or nothing? Let's see if she's got 8 seconds in her.
The former president looks at Haley. Her expression is all the confirmation the old man needs. She stands beside her parked Volkswagen, watching Andrew Wilde see off the other shooters. Regardless of party affiliation and from diverse professional backgrounds, all are dedicated members of the deeper state. Though they no longer hold exalted positions of power, they remain true to the oaths they took in their earliest government service days. Above and beyond politics, the men and women of Publius are the sworn, steadfast guardians of the United States Constitution. As he climbs into the passenger seat of his funeral black SUV, the former president gives Haley a friendly wave. She returns the gesture, smiling. After the other vehicles lumber off, Wilde walks over to where Haley waits. He offers her a canvas range bag, a Nighthawk custom logo embroidered on the side. A gift from your newest admirer. His displeasure is obvious. The deeper state operative can scarcely believe it.
Are you serious? A custom 1911 is worth thousands of dollars.
The gift isn't the reason Andrew Wilde is upset with her.
6 months sitting behind a desk is what you deserve.
Because it's the world's first completely virtual security organization, sir, Publius doesn't have a desk for me to sit behind. He ignores her jibe.
Jumping rank like that. I'd kick your ass if I thought I had half a chance against you.
The president invited me to shoot, Mr. Wilde, says Haley. So I shot.
Afterward?
We got to talking about his home state, says Haley disingenuously.
And about Charlie Hicks, Fort Bliss, and some nebulous storm, whatever the hell that is, says Wilde, making his point in no uncertain terms.
Of course, Haley could tell him now about what she found in the brick home in Arlington, drop on Wilde the same bombshell that obliterated the memory of her father. Would revealing that secret to her superior gain his cooperation? She decides to keep these secrets to herself. Why exactly, she's not sure. Shame? Or is she worried that her father's imperfections will cast her in a negative light? Haley hopes she's a better daughter than that. What happened to my dad? It could be part of something big, sir.
Or it could just be another fucked up thing that happened one day in the middle of a shitty war in Iraq.
There's only one way to find out, sir.
And your new pal, the former president, would like you to do just that.
London?
We'll put someone else on it, wise ass.
He turns for his vehicle, walking away and not looking back.
Don't be a stranger.
On the interstate again, the road unspools with predictable monotony. Haley considers calling Sam. With a flight booked for early tomorrow morning, she has no time to see him before leaving town. He will want to know when she'll be returning. More questions will follow, none of which come with a satisfactory response. She decides against calling him. Despite a pang of nagging guilt, Haley feels the relief of being unfettered. Involving Publius in investigating the sordid mystery of her father's double life and suicide has forced her hand. What had April said? Go, but don't go it alone. Haley recognizes now she needed the deeper state's official sanction. With Wilde's blessing, the two threads, personal and national, are inextricably intertwined. One cannot be unraveled without the other. In her bones, she senses the darkness that lies ahead. Her intentions are pure. The pursuit of truth. And on the heads of the wicked, vengeance. He is dressed and pulling on his Nakona boots 3 minutes after getting the call. The sky outside his bedroom window,
the same view he's enjoyed every pre-dawn of his life except while in the Marines, is cobalt blue. A few minutes before 5 a.m., the moon has long since plunked below the Chihuahuan desert horizon. Standing, Sheriff's Deputy Jay Gibbs retrieves his cowboy hat from the dresser, where he left it the night before.
Brim side up so his luck doesn't run out. He places the hat on his head and squares it.
Most of the other deputies opt for the department ball cap.
But his father gave him the resist all 2 years before he passed. Not much keeps Gibbs from wearing the straw cattleman 24 hours a day but sleep. The screen door bangs closed behind him, like a rifle shot. He has been alone here since 2016, the summer his old man died. 2 years ago, a girlfriend stayed around for a few months, but he has been on his own since then. And just as well. The job keeps him busy enough. His other passion is reading, as evidenced by the few thousand books stacked throughout the house. Mysteries, thrillers, true crime, history, and biographies. Forget about science fiction and fantasy. Gibbs never developed a taste for genres that, in his opinion, value typing over actual writing. The department prowler, a white Chevy Tahoe with twin high-vis gold metallic Reeves County Sheriff vehicle wraps covering all four doors, is parked out front. Summoned for assistance in yet another crisis, Deputy Gibbs never ceases to relish this feeling of utility, an existence imbued with civic duty, as he shoots driveway gravel from under the Tahoe's rear tires, answering the call. Taking 285 south to 232, he spots an orange glow in the sky. That would be in the general direction of the Maverick cryo facility. Gibbs overtakes other emergency vehicles and first responders rushing to the scene, swinging the SUV onto the road's shoulder and keeping his foot on the gas. He knows a couple of the guys who work in the plant, a midstream facility for natural gas processing. But Maverick hasn't worked a graveyard shift since the boom years of 2018 and 2019. The pandemic drove oil and gas prices to historic lows, valuations that haven't recovered to this day. Hell, three-quarters of the basin is out of work. Gibbs is confident no personnel are inside the Maverick facility, 26 miles northwest of Pecos. Fire engines and sheriff department SUVs block the road as he comes within 1,000 feet of the facility. Gibbs rolls to a stop off the shoulder, the prowler nearly swallowed up by a stand of bloodweed. Opening the driver's door creates an open space in the tangle of vegetation, and the deputy exits the vehicle. The conflagration's roar shocks, a noise both terrifying and mesmerizing. His nostrils fill with the tendrils of the burning, acrid plume that swirls over the entire site. An EMT truck from Pecos pulls up behind him. Gibbs shouts at the tech who spills out, "Shouldn't be no one in there, Dickie!" The medical technician doesn't slow his pace as he runs toward the blazing facility.
"Well, I hear otherwise, deputy."
Gibbs falls in behind the other man, jogging toward the site. He witnessed firsthand the effects of explosion and fire on a human body. Afghanistan, where a mortar's direct hit on an ammo dump ignited a massive explosion. A semi on the interstate engulfed in flames. The ranch house in Hermosa that caught fire, trapping a family of five. Those memories repeatedly return to Jay Gibbs, like blackbirds on a telephone wire. In his sleep, when patrolling dark Texas highways in the Prowler, the mind's movie projector never stops casting its horror show in lurid technicolor. The bodies aren't recovered from the facility for another 7 hours, in the cruel glare of a midday sun. Gibbs is on the scene, of course, along with many of the same investigators from the Wink fire. As with that incident, identification of the two victims won't be an easy task. At the fire's worst, temperatures inside the plant reached 750 degrees. Both corpses presented a pugilistic attitude, with flexed elbows and knees. Calvaria were free of soft tissue, with pronounced fissures of the tabula externa. Body cavities burst open, revealing fire-shrunken internal organs.
Flames destroyed the extremities, too, leaving only torsos that broke apart when forensics team members attempted to transfer them to body bags.
Total incineration, the county coroner pronounced, was averted by Pecos Volunteer Fire Department's diligent efforts to knock down the blaze.
The same Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives agent confers with the same agent from the Texas Railroad Commission, palavering separately from county authorities. Investigators from the fire marshal's office expect to arrive on site within the hour. Texas Rangers promise to weigh in, too. The second incident of sabotage in the Permian Basin is a big deal, with global ramifications. Authorities have collected a backpack relatively undamaged by the fire as evidence. The bag and its contents, a malfunctioning improvised explosive device and 16-inch Bowie knife, are already on their way to the ATF's field office in Dallas. Jay Gibbs pokes his head into the still smoldering ruins of the cryo plant as one of the volunteer firefighters is coming out.
Where they find him, Alberto?
He points to the corner of the building nearest the door. Almost made it out of here. Stepping inside, Gibbs visually measures the distance from the doorway to the location. The fireman, Alberto Jimenez, wants to help. Everyone watches cop and detective shows on television, right? They all think they know enough to have an idea or two about police work. At least that's been Gibbs's experience. Alberto says, maybe they got disoriented.
Maybe.
Didn't I see you up at the Wink Fire, too?
Yep, you saw me.
You hear about the bomb? The FBI already sent it off to Dallas. He has to smile at that one. Already sent it off to Dallas. That's what they call a trope. In his spare time, Gibbs is trying his hand at the author business. He's read a couple of how-to books on the subject, even took an online class he didn't quite finish. Plenty of law enforcement folks take up creative writing. Some of them have been pretty damn successful. Rich, even. No reason to think the profession is beyond him. Aim high, as Daddy always told him. Don't sell yourself short. One of these days, Gibbs is going to write a short story, and once he's published a few of those tales of crime on the highways and byways of West Texas, then he'll write a novel, too. Modern-day westerns, like that fella C.J. Box. How many times has he said those exact words to a buddy over beers at Freddy's Ice House? Having worked for the Reeves County Sheriff for the past 3 years, with three more in the Marine Corps Military Police before that, Gibbs believes he has amassed all the material he needs, and then some.
What's so funny? Asks Alberto. Nothing's funny about two men dead, Al.
Think them Mex drug cartels are paying us back for interdicting their shipments north? Asks the volunteer fireman, an insurance salesman by profession.
That's what I hear.
Gibbs studies the plant's interior where the two bodies had been recovered, focusing on the door leading outside. Casual inspection reveals the door is fire-rated, self-closing, and equipped with a panic bar. If the Mexican drug cartels are indeed sending their foot soldiers north to wreak havoc on the Permian Basin, then it occurs to the Reeves County Sheriff's deputy that they ought to be able to afford a flashlight or two. A cell phone, even.
Shoot, Alberto. How about leaving a little of this police work for me? What do you say? Asks Gibbs.
3. Can you help your country out, big fella? She watches the landscape go from green to brown to bone white as the plane flies over Texas. Haley has been out west before, stationed at Fort Hood while in the Army. But the desert panorama is a shock after so many years on the East Coast. She presses her head against the cold airplane window, entranced by the vast emptiness. From 35,000 feet, it's possible to imagine hers is an overflight of some alien planet, devoid of people, peaceful, unmarred by human intrigue. But then comes the plane's descent. The edges of habitation come into view. Roads and highways are sutures in the desert landscape. Residential neighborhoods, shopping centers, roads and parking lots. The works of man flatten ancient sandstone ridges and erase flood-eroded ravines. El Paso. Her body offers an involuntary shudder. Lifting her gaze, Haley looks past the city, past the Franklin Mountains that bisect it east from west, to the south into Mexico, and an immensity she cannot comprehend. The Chihuahuan Desert is 140,000 square miles in size. The U.S. and Mexican border cities on either side of the Rio Grande are merely a stain on its immense canvas. The woman at the car rental agency gives her directions to the Beverly Crest Motor Inn, the same motel where her dad stayed in each of his three visits.
Haley pulls into the lot, a few blocks west of Dyer, less than 15 minutes later. The single-story motel has a Motor Inn-style layout with an office that shares the building with a muffler shop. But the location is good. The Patriot Freeway less than a mile away. Haley can be at the main gate of Fort Bliss inside of 10 minutes. A fitness center beckons a short jog up 9th Cavalry Circle, and for longer runs, McKelligan Canyon Road, leading into the highest reaches of the Franklin Mountains, is practically outside her door. The manager, Jerry, according to a name tag, handles the check-in process. He's mostly bald, with long rockabilly sideburns and dandruff on his black Western-style shirt. Haley isn't sure if the shirt is part of a uniform or not. The big window unit that expels chilled air rattles with a bored, never-going-to-be-repaired resignation, underscoring a vibe that is unrelentingly sub-budget. Haley doesn't mind. She isn't here for vacation.
"We have free HBO, just so you know," says Jerry as he taps on his computer keyboard, entering Haley's information in slow motion.
Haley recognizes this hemming and hawing as an obnoxious form of flirtation. Making nice with him when she walked through the door was an unfortunate necessity. First on her agenda was showing the motel manager a photo of her father. With only that much of an exchange between them, Jerry makes unfortunate assumptions. And for all of that, the skeevy dude had no fresh information for her regarding Tommy Chill. All before his time employed at the motel. While the motel manager fiddles with his computer, Haley leaves the counter and approaches a bulletin board on an opposite wall. Flyers advertise pancake breakfasts, garage sales, and offers of day labor, hauling and painting services.
Haley saw enough empty storefronts and homes for sale on her drive from the airport to comprehend the economic impact of the oil market's collapse on the region.
Times are tough in the Permian Basin. El Paso derives enviable financial stability from the military's presence. Fort Bliss and the $8 billion the Army installation dumps into its host city's economy every year serve as a necessary buffer against the oil industry's vicissitudes. Nevertheless, high unemployment and economic disarray encroach even here in El Paso. The desperation conveyed by the bulletin board's homemade flyers is ample evidence of that fact. One flyer in particular catches Haley's eye, a missing person notice. The photograph is of a 15-year-old girl wearing a navy UTEP hoodie.
With black hair and dark eyes, the girl possesses an innocent beauty that is achingly tenuous and fragile.
Kimberly is missing for 3 months now. Her father offers $5,000 for information leading to her recovery. Handwritten and inelegantly photocopied, the flyer is a cry for help, steeped with pain and anguish. The deeper state operative can't drag her eyes off it. This girl. She could have been one of Haley's sisters. She could have been Haley.
"Work or pleasure?" asks the motel manager.
"Business," Haley says, returning to the counter. He pushes a signing card across the glass-topped counter.
Haley signs and accepts a card key from the motel manager.
Only he doesn't release his grip on it.
"Need to blow off a little steam. You know who to call."
His grin is mostly a leer. Jerry Fishbaugh has been running things here at the Beverly Crest Motor Inn for the last 5 weeks, pretty much with free rein. The owner is Chinese and has never visited the United States, let alone El Paso. As long as Fishbaugh surpasses a relatively low threshold monthly numbers-wise, the 42-room motel is his kingdom, where his subjects defy him at risk of deportation. Born and raised in Tulsa, the motel manager was stationed at Fort Bliss following his enlistment and never left. His apartment is up in northeast El Paso. Pretty sweet place. His assistant manager, a college dropout named Boone, does all the real work. Some days Fishbaugh doesn't bother showing his face around here. But Boone drove over to Dallas for the week, so there you go. The upside: if Fishbaugh was at home in northeast El Paso today instead of behind the office counter, he wouldn't be here to check in this fine piece of ass.
Haley tugs the card key free of his pincer grip and turns away from the counter without comment.
The motel manager watches her to the door. She parks her rental car in front of room 32, mercifully at the opposite end of the property from the motel office. A housekeeper's cleaning cart is positioned just outside the room door, which is ajar. Haley grabs her travel duffel from the back seat and pokes her head inside the room. With painted cinder block walls, comboed desk dresser, campus refrigerator, microwave, framed landscape prints, and queen-size bed shrouded in a paisley comforter. The accommodations are basic. A housekeeper, roughly Haley's age and Hispanic, has finished cleaning the room. Gathering her supplies, she hurries to make way for a paid guest. Haley wants to put her at ease.
It's okay, I can wait.
I'm sorry, miss,
she says, gaze lowered.
I'm finished.
As the housekeeper exits through the open door, Haley can see her left eye is black and blue, with a 2-day-old bruise. Her instructions are to use the Chaffee Gate. It's noon when Haley parks in the lot and enters the small utilitarian visitor control center. A civilian employee wordlessly gestures toward a stack of clipboards and official forms when Haley suggests that Criminal Investigation Command has left a pass for her. Enlisted personnel are more helpful. The acne-scarred private accesses the appropriate file on his computer and prints out the necessary paperwork. Thanking the 19-year-old for his assistance, Haley exits the robustly air-conditioned visitor center and steps back outside into the hard sunshine. Washington, D.C. in August has nothing on West Texas. The air stings with a white heat. Haley calls Chief Warrant Officer Roy Pogue from her car after leaving the Chaffee Gate. An agent for the U.S. Army Criminal Investigation Command, he gives her directions to the 76th Military Police Detachment headquarters and meets her out front 3 minutes later, seemingly oblivious to the blast furnace temperature. Pogue is tall and broad-shouldered, a dark-skinned black man with warm eyes and smile. With the CID for the last 7 years and a military police officer before that, Pogue is dedicated in equal measure to law and order. Unlike most military personnel on the post, he is not in uniform. His civilian clothes, suit and tie, always, are spotless and exceptionally well-pressed. He holds the door open for Haley and directs her to his office on the first floor, a cubicle with a window view of the parking lot. From her seat across the CID agent's desk, Haley can see the framed photos of Pogue's wife and 2 grown daughters. Nice-looking family. He has good reason to smile, Haley decides. A fortunate man.
Private Timothy Hooker, absent without leave.
Pogue's declaration comes without preamble or pleasantries. The deeper state sent Haley to El Paso with a cover as the aide to U.S. Senator Gordon Powell, who serves on the Committee on Armed Services. With pending retirement from the Senate after decades of service, Powell has already been approached by former colleagues associated with Publius. From the great state of Kentucky and an ardent believer in the U.S. Constitution, the retiring senator was more than happy to assist in the operation. If anyone bothers to call his office on Capitol Hill, Haley Chill's credentials will be faithfully confirmed. The deeper state operative has done her work, of course. In the first hour of her flight west, Haley committed to memory all the information in a thick dossier on the senator's life and long political career. Private Hooker's military status is unwelcome news. He became Haley's primary person of interest with an analysis of her father's phone records. Tommy Chill made several calls in the last 6 months of his life to an Arizona cell phone number. Andrew Wilde had been able to put a name to the number in short order, but made no mention of Hooker being AWOL. Since when, Mr. Pogue?
3 weeks ago. His company commander held off making the report until yesterday, hoping Hooker would wander back. I only found out when I called over there this morning in anticipation of your visit.
Article 85, sir? Haley asks, referring to a charge of desertion.
Too soon to say. Some of these kids get homesick. Some of them just get tired of being told what to do all the time. Most just need a kick in the pants. From what the company commander reports, Hooker wasn't homesick. He shrugs. Soldier with a problem.
Yes, Mr. Pogue. I understand.
Your former military.
3rd Cavalry Chief.
And the pride of our South, Pogue says with a mouthful of teeth showing.
He'd done his research, too. Haley is modest to a fault.
Yes, sir.
Buddy of mine is CID at Fort Hood. He saw one of your fights. Said you were a real badass.
He draws out the last word. Another toothy grin.
Good times, Mr. Pogue. Glad I gave your friend a good show.
He gestures at the thin file folder on his otherwise pristine desktop.
Can I ask what this is all about?
I'm afraid I can't say much more than that my investigation is a committee matter, Chief. Do you think I can have a look at Private Hooker's quarters? The CID agent indicates a cardboard box on the floor next to the door.
From his barracks. Every personal item he didn't take with him.
Thank you, sir, says Haley, appreciating Pogue's intuition and efficiency.
Okay, then, he says brightly, standing to retrieve the box from the floor.
He places it on the desk for Haley's inspection.
I'll let you get to it.
Pogue pauses in the doorway.
Let us know if you locate Hooker, won't you, Ms. Chill?
Yes, sir, of course.
He nods.
Happy hunting.
Once Pogue is gone, Haley pulls the box toward her and begins to remove its contents.
Hooker didn't leave much behind. Personal hygiene products, an Alamo paperweight, a few band-released thrash metal CDs, phone charger. No pictures, no papers.
Nothing that would suggest a connection to Tommy Chill or his job at the Pentagon. At the bottom of the box is one book, a battered paperback copy of Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince. Haley is on the verge of repacking the box when she stops. Retrieving the book, she riffles through them to where she finds a folded sheet of paper wedged between the pages. Unfolding the paper reveals that it's filled margin to margin with rows of random 1, 2, and 3-digit numbers. The same type of ciphered text she found on the pages from under the floorboards in her father's kitchen. An early dinner at a Mexican joint a few blocks north on Dyer seems substantially more preferable than heating something with the microwave in her room. She has time to kill before checking out the strip joint her father visited each time he was in town. With no evidence of his being a habitué of that sort of establishment back home, Haley is confident these trips to the Aphrodite Gentleman's Club were somebody else's idea. Timothy Hooker, perhaps? The strip joint is worth checking out. El Toro Negro is all but deserted at 5:30. Finishing her tamale, Haley checks her Kryptol phone, a device used exclusively to communicate with her superior in Publius, Andrew Wilde. There are no messages from him. With the full brunt of the deeper state's resources, she hoped at least the vague outlines of a conspiracy within the military would emerge. What exactly is the storm? How deep was Tommy Chill's involvement with the Cabal? And what's their agenda?
Want some more iced tea, honey?
The middle-aged waitress has approached the table with a fresh pitcher. Haley nods.
Thank you.
Haley pushes her plate toward the server.
Finished? Those beans are homemade.
I'm good, ma'am. Thank you.
Juanita Cruz was born in El Paso. Her mother crossed when she was pregnant. Working at the restaurant for the past 26 years, Juanita has put 2 daughters through nursing school. El Toro Negro is a family place. Over the years, she has waited on hundreds of female soldiers from the sprawling army post. White, black, brown, or Asian, those young women are all much like Haley. Serious, respectful. Always leave a tip, however modest. The male soldiers can be a bit rowdier at times. But even the young men in the military are better customers to have in the restaurant than civilians. Better people.
You like your tamale?
It was delicious,
Haley says, smiling. Juanita returns the smile.
You should eat more, mijita. You're too skinny.
Haley nods. She has heard this before from other mother surrogates.
Live music on the weekends,
Juanita says over her shoulder, turning for the only other occupied table on the floor. Checking her watch, the deeper state operative reaches inside her canvas and leather tote for her wallet. After many years of slinging a backpack, the bag was a gift to herself when she was promoted from White House intern to paid staffer. Haley's nickname for the shoulder bag is Mother. Like most women, she keeps what feels like half of her entire existence in the tote at any given time. Essential documents, laptop computer, the modest amount of makeup she typically uses, books she's reading or thinking about reading, a fighting knife, depending on the occasion, and on this day, a pregnancy test, purchased at a Walgreens on her way to the airport back home in D.C. Touching the box while retrieving her wallet reminds Haley of a telltale anxiety she has pushed to the furthest recesses of her consciousness. An explanation for her recent fatigue and occasional nausea. She cannot imagine that she is pregnant, the chances of it being just so incredibly slim. Haley wishes she hadn't purchased the test kit in the first place, reassessing it now as a waste of money and evidence of needless worry. A news broadcast on the television behind the restaurant's compact bar diverts her attention. With the audio muted, captions and video tell the story of the second case of sabotage to hit the Permian Basin. On this occasion, a natural gas processing facility outside of Pecos, Texas, 200 miles to the east. Haley had read early news reports about the fire and explosion at the Maverick cryo facility when she landed earlier. Several hours have passed since the explosion. The breaking news now, however, is that the governor has called out the Texas National Guard to protect the state's valuable oil and gas infrastructure from alleged narco-terrorists. Juanita has paused in her work to watch the news also. When the broadcast cuts to a commercial for a local Ford dealership, the waitress exchanges a worried look with Haley. Not good. The strip joint is 7 miles north on Dyer, in a cluttered, downscale neighborhood of mobile home parks, fast food franchises, and auto salvage shops. Aphrodite Gentleman's Club, a one-story stucco box with a faded awning and oil-stained parking lot, is literally at civilization's edge. Outside its back door is only desert. Hundreds of square miles of chaparral, rattlesnakes, and unrelenting wind. Haley parks across the street at precisely 7 p.m. Tommy's credit card records indicate he was at the strip joint between 6 and 8 p.m., off-peak hours when there's no cover charge and dancers can hang with their regulars. The deeper state operative accesses Hooker's army portrait on her phone. White male, with thinning brown hair and a feral look in eyes that are a touch too far apart, he seems to drown in his combat uniform. Haley committed the man's face to memory when Pogue first emailed the photo, but feels a need to sear the image into her brain again. It begins, she muses. Haley hasn't spent much time in strip joints, but the Aphrodite matches her experience from those few previous occasions. Lights down low. Bar to the left, stage to the right. VIP booths in the rear. Polished cement floor. A pervasive odor of cheap perfume and industrial-strength cleaning fluid. Attendance is sparse. The woman on stage works the pole with athletic efficiency, but wholly out of sync with the eardrum-busting beats of rap music pumping from the sound system. A dozen customers hold court at the rack, tables that ring the 2-foot-high stage. Tipping every dance is de rigueur and wins a few moments of special attention from the performing dancer. Clusters of young men occupy all but one of the front row tables. Their regulation haircuts, age, and physical fitness betray their military status. The club's sound system obliterates any idea of conversation. With weary smiles, women wearing G-strings work the floor. The club is its own world. Outside is another. Haley hangs back, taking a seat at the bar. The bartender is a 45-year-old ex-con with a face of a middle-aged Val Kilmer and the heart of a young Mel Gibson. The dancers call him Mr. Highlights for, well, his weakness for balayage. Only the club's owner knows his real name. Leonard Pfeiffer. He's not here by dint of his mixing skills. The Aphrodite is strictly BYOB. But for his 6-foot-8-inch frame and G5 rating in Krav Maga. Pfeiffer's boyfriend appreciates the lack of competition at an all-female review. The Aphrodite gets its share of lesbians walking through the door, more than a few. But Mr. Highlights decides the conservative-looking, flaxen-haired, powder-blue-eyed Haley, his only customer at the bar, isn't here for the dancers. Without even looking at her, Pfeiffer can sense Haley scanning the room. She doesn't seem like the pissed-off wife type either. Cop, the bartender thinks. Maybe CID. He pours Haley a tall glass of soda water with a squeeze of lime. She nods her thanks and places a $20 bill beside the glass in payment for the barstool's short-term rental. Pfeiffer lets the 20 ride. Haley doesn't seem the type to claw back a tip. After four dancers have cycled through their sets and another tall glass of soda water, Haley begins to doubt her strategy. How many nights can she camp out on this bar stool at the Aphrodite and suffer the pitying looks of the bartender? If Hooker is AWOL or Article 85, would he risk revisiting these familiar haunts? Haley considers showing the bartender a photo, but if Hooker is a regular, he and the bartender might be pals. She'd prefer not to tip her hand. But Hooker is a first and vital link in the chain. Without actionable information from him, there may be no further investigation. Andrew Wilde's patience isn't unlimited, and Haley presently doesn't have any other leads. She motions to the bartender, who ambles down to her end of the bar. Slipknot's Nero Forte thunders from the sound system. Haley places her work phone on the bar, displaying Hooker's army portrait. Pfeiffer barely looks before lifting his gaze to meet Haley's. His expression is, "Yeah?" She gestures for him to come closer. Mr. Highlights leans his long frame over the bar, putting his ear within shouting distance of her lips. "I'm not a cop!" The bartender pulls away, shrugs.
"So?"
She gestures. He leans in again. Haley cups her hand around his ear. "Can you help your country out, big fella?" The bartender wasn't expecting that one. He knows Hooker, of course. The guy's a total freak. But a threat to the United States? The blonde, though, seems to be a straight arrow. No arguing that. Mr. Highlights finds himself unusually sympathetic toward his customer seated at the bar. It's nothing sexual, no reason for his boyfriend to be concerned. But this young lady possesses a seriousness that impresses the bouncer bartender. Leonard Pfeiffer decides she is deserving of his trust. The bartender leans over the bar again, cupping his massive hand around her ear, and says with a low voice,
"He's here. You've been staring at him all night."
Haley pulls away in surprise and looks over the room again, not seeing Hooker. Pfeiffer points his chin at a couple seated at the rack. Heavy-set balding guy wearing a t-shirt and his skinny female date. Haley fixes her gaze on the woman and, after a few seconds of scrutiny, realizes she's looking at Tim Hooker. By means of vigilant shaving, hiding gaff with tucking ring, high-rise padded control panties, dazzling metallic dress, black synthetic wig, drag queen strappy sandals, and a cosplay false bust, the army deserter does a reasonable job of passing himself off as a woman, however trashy. Despite generously applied facial makeup, Haley identifies Hooker by his eyes, mouth, and jawline. Captivated by the dancer on stage, the army deserter and his companion fail to notice Haley's preoccupation with them. She has no idea whether Hooker's cross-dressing is a proclivity or disguise and couldn't care less either way. He doesn't appear to be leaving anytime soon. One of the dancers working the floor has sat in his lap and whispers in his ear. As a precaution, Haley moves to the far end of the bar. From this new vantage point, at low risk of being observed by her target, she keeps watch for another hour as Hooker and his companion take turns accepting solicitations for multiple lap dances. Finally, after the army private makes five additional trips to the VIP booths in the back, the two men seem done for the night. Haley slides off the bar stool, looking toward the bartender and nodding her goodbye. Pfeiffer strides down to the end of the bar and offers her a massive fist to bump. The deeper state operative grins and bangs with the not-so-gentle giant, leaving the 20 next to her third glass of water. The bartender cannot appreciate the impact of his small assistance to Haley. Though they will never meet again, he will think of her often, especially after the momentous events to follow. Only then will the bartender suspect the role he may have played, an involvement he will never mention to another soul. Mr. Highlights will keep his job at the strip joint on Civilization's Edge for another 3 years, until the night he takes only his two Hulk-sized fists to a gunfight in the Aphrodite parking lot and dies on that oil-stained cement. Every dancer in the joint will attend Leonard Pfeiffer's funeral, unaware of the question Haley put to him that altered the course of history. Can you help your country out, big fella? From inside her rental car parked across the street, Haley watches Hooker and his friend leave the gentleman's club. The army deserter totters unsteadily on the strappy, thin-heeled sandals and removes them halfway across the parking lot from his pickup truck. His buddy detours to the 15-year-old Cadillac STS parked in the adjacent space. Their goodbyes are perfunctory. The forlorn engine start of the two vehicles breaks the relative silence. The STS heads north on Dyer, swallowed up by the dark Chihuahuan desert. The battered pickup heads south, with Haley on its tail a block behind. Hooker takes Woodrow Bean Trans Mountain Drive west into the Franklin Mountains that bisect the city, and then transitions onto westbound Interstate 10 into New Mexico. At this late hour, the road is mostly deserted. Past Barino, Mesquite, through Las Cruces, transitioning again to Interstate 25 and following the Rio Grande north past Radium Springs, a closed U.S. Border Patrol checkpoint, and Rincon, the passing landscape wider and ever more desolate, with an eternity of night sky overhead. South of Truth or Consequences, where the river is plugged by a cement barrier to create the Caballo Reservoir, Hooker's pickup leaves the interstate and sweeps past a state park campground before turning right at an unmarked county road. Following a few hundred yards behind, Haley continues straight, driving past the two-lane county road. Glancing to her right, she watches the pickup truck's red taillights stare back at her like devil eyes, retreating into the void of darkness until they disappear entirely. She reverses at the turnoff for the dam and backtracks to the interstate, confronting the army deserter in the pitch black of San Andres Hill country, dug in whatever shithole redoubt he has found there, would not be smart work. As she accelerates to a cruising speed on the interstate, heading south toward El Paso, Haley devises her plan. After his night of carousing at the Aphrodite Gentleman's Club, she surmises that Hooker won't be leaving his lair above the Caballo Reservoir very early in the morning. The deeper state operative expects to find him home if she returns by noon, a schedule that allows her to make a necessary stop beforehand.